Hey folks, welcome to the Table Podcast. This is a recorded just for the podcast version of I Doubt It Part 2. It's a little different than what we did when we were together online live, just because that one was a little more sprawling and I'd like this to be a bit focused in the podcast format, but the same content is here. So yeah, if you're somebody that's listening to this or wondering if you should pass it along to a friend that wasn't able to join us live, and it's a series, so maybe you're wondering if that's a good idea. All the same stuff is there, just that some of the extemporaneous bits won't be. We are continuing our exploration on the topic of doubt today. And when we did this together live, we made a little detour in terms of our order and how we enter a space. And we stopped to breathe together first, which I won't take the time to do in the podcast version. But we spent a bit more time on that because in this exploration, we're just going to jump right into the deep end with some further consideration of this fresh outpouring of grief and attention that has taken place here in Canada, where I live and where I'm recording this, because of the discovery on the property around a residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia, of a whole bunch of unmarked children's graves. And there's been a global response to that, and a national one as well, and a personal one. And we're going to re-engage with that a little bit. We explored it a bit last week and talked about it a bit, but we're going to re-engage with that, especially as regards its possible connection to experiences of doubt. And we chose the different order going into the space because I felt like we could really use the silence and the stillness first because of what we were going to wade into. So we did that. And I would encourage you, if you're listening on the podcast, to hit the pause button if this is a practice in your life, and just take a few moments or a few minutes or a few hours, whatever you need, to just stop and breathe and be still. Take in life, take in grace, take in strength, and then we'll go exploring. We live and we gather in this part of the continent on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We, and I say we, as signifying those who would choose to affirm this statement, we respect the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, and we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership with Indigenous communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. One of the reasons I almost always begin our talky bits together with that land acknowledgement is because doing so, I mean, many reasons, but one of them is just that doing so gets my eyes at least temporarily off my daily assumptions and distractions and onto an ongoing, essential, and incomplete process. In this particular case, it gets my thinking and my spirit turned toward the truth that the religion that I grew up in, a religion grounded in the teachings of Jesus, whose core human ethic and only commandment to his followers really was love one another, that religion colluded with the government I live under as a citizen of the Dominion of Canada to treat fellow humans as less than human. In the name of God and country, and it gets my eyes onto the fact that this was and is profoundly wrong and must both be reconciled and also not perpetuated in any way. Now, of course, all of this has been re-stirred in some ways by the discovery that I already mentioned, the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children buried in unmarked graves near this residential school in Kamloops. I'm not using the specific number for those, how many of those children and graves there are. There's been a number frequently used in the media, but I'm deliberately not using that number as a gesture toward those not yet found, not to diminish the individuality or the grief or the particularity of those already located. And more on that in a moment. You would think, or at least I would think, that news like this is enough to make anybody doubt both of those institutions, both church and state, in some significant ways. And for some folks, it is enough. I got an email from someone this past week in which the writer said that they were having difficulty imagining the church as representing anything other than calculated evil. It's a very strong statement, but that makes sense to me. On the other hand, for most of us, it only maybe takes a moment to think of someone we know who's totally convinced that their traditional Christian beliefs are the only possible true beliefs, and that to deviate from those beliefs in any way is to jeopardize body, mind, and spirit. And there's every reason why these may be loving, beautiful people, people who would also feel sad about the historic fact of the abuses perpetuated in residential schools. They are, in ways that we would all recognize in an instant, good people. But there is a huge discernible difference between those two perspectives and experiences. It's really tempting, but I think extremely short-sighted to think that it's what people believe that makes them good. The churches that ran the residential schools on behalf of the government of Canada all have statements of belief that run along the lines of traditional Christian beliefs. And that sentence about churches running schools on behalf of the government, they operated them and were paid by the government of Canada. So that's the relationship I wanted to indicate there. Listen, if you wish, you can look this up. The churches that history identifies as the prevailing ones that ran the residential schools were the denominations known in Canada as Anglican, United, Roman Catholic, and Presbyterian, all of which would affirm standard traditional Christian beliefs about the nature of God, the deity of Jesus, the structural nature of sin and redemption, the inspiration of the Bible, and so on, all those kind of cardinal Christian doctrines. I should also mention that after we covered this material in our talkie bit this past Sunday, one of the folks in the community, very thoughtful individual, as many of the people in the community are, and a reader, somebody who really absorbs a lot of material, sent me a Facebook post reminding me that although those are sort of the predominant and named denominations, people from many other Christian denominations were involved. And this person's background is with Mennonite denomination, and they pointed in that post to an article and a personal experience with some folks, Mennonite folks, who had been involved teaching in one of those residential schools. And so lots of people under the banner of Christian involved in that project. I'm not sure how I feel about the word project. By the way, I am fully cognizant of the fact that there are lots of people that identify as Christian that couldn't sign off on any number of those, what I call, you know, cardinal doctrines or beliefs these days. But stay with me for a moment, because my point is not about personal identity. It's about the problematic nature of right belief. In the majority of cases, the people that actually operated the residential schools worked for the church. In most instances, they were officials of the church. They were priests, nuns, what we might now call in other denominations or other settings, pastoral or ministry staff. In the classrooms of those schools, they taught the children about Christianity as it is defined by those doctrines and creeds. They taught them that these beliefs defined their humanity, that these were the beliefs that could complete them as persons, make them fully human, if you will. And in many instances, they also starved them, beat them, abused them, and in staggeringly high percentages, by one government report, as high as 24% of the kids in those schools, killed them or allowed them to die of those abuses. And as though such a dehumanizing death were not sufficient erasure, in many more instances than have yet been confirmed by location, buried them in unmarked graves. To some folks hearing this news story, I mean, to all of us, I think it's an appalling story and a shock, and a grievous shock for all sorts of obvious reasons. But it's not a shock because it's unimaginable or because it was unknown. The Indigenous community has known about their children being buried in unmarked graves because of their death in residential school settings for as long as it's been happening. Heard a story this past week of someone talking about walking around their community where they'd grown up near North Battleford in Saskatchewan, Canada, talking with an elder who was like pointing, also a residential school survivor, pointing to locations and saying, under that tree, this child and that child are buried, and under this tree, this child is buried. And so the stories were there. They just weren't being told publicly. Listen, all of that I was thinking about it. My family pet gets considerably better treatment than that. And even if I held the sternest of Christian beliefs, I wouldn't be treating my pet better because I was concerned about my puppy's soul. There's a summary of this period of history that's published online by the Indigenous Foundations at UBC, and that summary includes this note. Quote, some former students have positive memories of their time at residential schools, and certainly some might have been treated with kindness by the priests and nuns who ran the school as best they could, given the circumstances. But even these, quotes, good, close quotes, experiences occurred within a system aimed at destroying Indigenous cultures and assimilating Indigenous students. That summary also notes that many students died very shortly after leaving residential schools. We're not talking about death of old age here. We're talking about young Indigenous people, prime of life people in terms of chronology, dying very shortly after leaving the residential schools. Listen, that's a number we don't even know how to calculate. Maybe we'll find out we do know how to calculate, and the stories are there just like the unmarked graves. I don't know that, but I suspect that that one will be hard to measure. Because these are people that may not have been killed outright, but they were destroyed as persons in ways that made continuing to live impossible for them. The ripples from that destruction continue, and even under ideal circumstances, they're going to continue for some time to come. Many spiritual traditions, including the Hebrew and Judeo-Christian traditions, talk about the generations over which the sins of the children, or rather the sins of the fathers, are visited on their children. And in many Indigenous traditions, that's a seven-generation idea. So this is going to take a while. This is going to take a while. And that's horrible in itself. But it's a human reality, isn't it? That's the way this kind of suffering comes out over time. That kind of destruction, the destruction of the person, has recently touched this community, the Table, in the murder of Wally Chartrand's daughter's partner, followed not that much later by the death of his daughter herself. I have spent much of my adult life working in and around Christian institutions. Generally speaking, you don't get to do that without signing off on whatever those institutions regard as right belief. You know, the We Believe part on the church website. Maybe that's sort of the user-friendly, the religion light part. But then if you ask, you can see the whole document with the theological breakdown. Now, in my experience, you can say that you believe those statements. You can sign a document that says you believe those doctrines. You can tell the story of your conversion, of your baptism, your confirmation. However your tradition confirms your affiliation and affirmation with such beliefs. You can go on to an institution of higher religious learning, as I have. You can be trained by the church. You can become a religious expert. In other words, you can be what many people would call a believer and still kill children in the name of God and country. Right belief doesn't make us good. But in the context of our current exploration, here's the thing. I could go on outlining the problems inherent like a story like that of the residential schools all day. And for some of us, it would raise or affirm enormous doubts about what we've been taught was true. But for others, it would do something that seems the opposite of that. For some, it would just drive them deeper into positions they already hold. The key phrases would be repeated. The anchor verses would be quoted. The standard and readily recognizable beliefs and positions would be hammered home. And no story about the misbehavior of the religion in question would change that or raise substantial doubts about it. In the days subsequent to our initial exploration of this material in a Sunday talk a bit, Pope Francis, the Catholic Pope. And the Catholic denomination, I'm not being anti-Catholic here, this is just sort of historic fact. One of the reasons this is a newsworthy item, if you will, is because the Catholic Church ran the majority of the residential schools. They were the most involved denominationally. And so people look to the head of that church institutionally for a response. And Francis responded this week by saying that he was, you know, shocked and saddened and kind of joined with the people of Canada and the world in mourning this, and no apology. It says this is touches on the terrain we're talking about here, the complexity of saying, yes, that's sad, but it doesn't change anything that I believe. It doesn't kind of call it into question in a way that I would talk about. And remember, we're not talking about a good person, bad person scenario here. That's not the point. We're talking about doubt and how an experience like this for some of us raises doubts. And for other people, it seems to do something different than that. Now, by way of contrast to the kind of archetype I've been trying to describe, some people seem to have been on the doubt train since they were little kids. They've got stories about their eye-rolling responses to stories like the dividing of the Red Sea or whatever, you know, the sort of the miracle stories that they've been accumulating since they were in graded Sunday school. Or lots of us, you know, have stories about going away to university and sitting in a biology class and having that moment of, uh-oh, I don't think I can fit this story I'm being told in this classroom about the origins of humanity. I don't think I can fit that story snugly into the story that I was taught from a literal reading of Genesis. And I'm finding the one that I'm being taught here at the university a lot easier to believe than the one with talking snakes in it. Or for that matter, being deep into a career in ministry and sitting in front of a computer, you know, writing the sermon for the coming Sunday or the youth group devotional and realizing that what they're writing is what they know the people in the seats want to hear, what they're getting paid to say, but not what they themselves find believable. Maybe it's being in a philosophy class or listening to a thoughtful scientist speak and realize, man, you know, people have been wrestling with the big existential questions for a long time, you know, a lot longer than the time between when Jesus had something to teach and now. And they've had a pretty good crack at answering some of them in different ways. Those experiences, as we're talking about them here, we're going to characterize as experiences of doubt. And in many cases, having experiences like that can really rock our worlds. I want to dive into this exploration on doubt in as open a way as possible, which means, among other things, doing so in ways that welcome everyone into the exploration, whether you feel like you've always been a questioner, a critical thinker, a doubter, or whether the idea of experiencing doubt sends you straight to the edge of, you know, do that and you're lost, you know, the precipice of lostness, or anywhere in between. And having said that, I know that this will be most difficult for those more inclined to that, you know, doubt is bad group, than for those that feel like they identify with the people on the doubt train. So, as is always the case at the table, don't pick up what isn't for you. And can I also say, without dialing that statement back at all, that sometimes we just can't instantly know what's for us and what isn't. Sometimes we need to explore a bit first. We have to start with an open mind and heart, with curiosity and courage, rather than with closeness and fear. We have to go peek around the corner before we decide to not go on the journey. And sometimes we just need to take the information in and not judge it, because our story isn't over yet, and life might bring some of this back to mind at an important moment when it'll be of assistance, even if it doesn't feel that way right now. I'm going to do my best to facilitate this in ways that make that easier rather than harder, maybe in ways that are more like reading a book about the topic rather than going to an immersive weekend retreat, you know, where you might have to actually bare your soul on some of this stuff where somebody else can see what's going on for you. One of those ways that I believe I can help that to happen is by confessing my own bent in this. It'll be no surprise to people that have been around the community for a while to hear that I would think of myself as a natural doubter. I'm not saying that I've never experienced doubt as troubling or difficult. I have certainly had those experiences. In many cases, my doubts have been distressing to others, and that's never a nice space to occupy. In other cases, those same doubts have been a breath of fresh air, a renewal of hope for other people. So I get that exploring this isn't simple, and I also get that it might even be distressing. Maybe one of the nice things about doing this online is that it's so easy to step away. I would hope that the table is the kind of place where people would feel free to literally step away from a conversation that was too distressing to them, but I know that things like habits, social values, religious behaviors, inherited and otherwise, other factors can make that hard to do. So, to reiterate, stay with the exploration if you want to and are able to. Do some personal reflecting on it, and then as best you can discern, don't pick up what doesn't seem to be for you. All right. I want to get into the nitty-gritty of framing this just a bit before we leave it for today. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be working through a particular schema for what is generally referred to in the literature that explores these things as faith development. At one point in that, I'm going to spend some time distinguishing between faith and belief, which are two very different things, even though they often get conflated, especially in religious conversations. That conflation actually might be one of the reasons why we find something like church-run institutions and religious people with so-called right beliefs abusing others so disconcerting, because we haven't taken the time to parse that difference between faith and belief. But we're not going to start there. We're going to start with a disclaimer about the method. Ah, my goodness. If you feel like I've been disclaiming for the last, several minutes, I would say that's understandable. Nevertheless, any method or schema for understanding something has its limitations. And when it comes to deepening our understanding of something like the relationship between faith and doubt, we're already deep into the realm of mystery. So we're going to collide with some of those limitations head on as we go. And I just want to say that's okay. We don't do something like this to solve all the problems or answer all the questions. We do something like this to have better tools to explore those problems and questions. The image that came to mind when I was writing this was, it's sort of like we're trying to find a sturdier, longer stick to poke the hornet's nest with. I don't know if that'll resonate for you, but it did for me. That's the image that came to mind. Now, the outline that I'll be using assumes a couple of things, and central to those assumptions is that faith is not static. It's not one and done. In other words, the idea that our faith changes as we go is taken as a given. However, we'll also see that it doesn't change the same for everyone. In fact, for some folks, it probably really doesn't change that much at all over time. While for others, it's a bit of a runaway train. And for some of us, that change kind of comes in bursts, like lots of learning, where there's sort of a steep curve where we just feel like we're immersed in a doubt or learning or change process, and then it kind of plateaus and we work with those ideas for a while, and then whether it's encountering a new idea or a new community or a new conversation or we have a new experience that challenges something that we would have said we believed, then we kind of have another one of those steep inclines and then work with that for a while and so on. We're going to see that there are lots of general societal factors at work as well that suggest that evolving faith, or faith that moves through various stages, is happening to more and more people in this part of the world, and it's happening at younger and younger ages. So in terms of this model with these stages, we'll see how more and more people are moving through these stages sooner and sooner. That'll make more sense as we go, but let me just have a little prognosticator sort of moment here, if humor me on this one. If this kind of unfolds culturally the way that I suspected it will, instead of hearing so much in the religious conversations about people leaving religion, 26 million over the last few years in the U.S., just over 2 million somewhere identifying as leaving their religion that they grew up in every year these days, instead of that being the frequently recurring conversation and those kind of numbers, I think increasingly we're just going to see that young people they're not leaving religion because they're not joining it in the first place. That doesn't mean that they don't have faith, which might come as a surprise depending how we've been taught about faith and belief. Anyway, hopefully some of you that are listening to this are young and, younger than me, and we'll get to kind of watch that unfold and be a part of its unfolding. So What I'm going to do at the end of this talky bit is share a bit of an overview of the model that I'll be using. And as always, this isn't some kind of last word. It's a particular lens. It's a model that I'm borrowing primarily from Brian D. McLaren, public theologian and author, speaker. And McLaren has assembled this based on his own considerable research into a whole pile of thinking and writing in this realm, much of which he's thoughtfully documented and which can be accessed for those that want to dig deeper. I'm not going to load this exploration up with all of that because this isn't a class, you know, but if you want to read the source materials, just let me know and I'm happy to pass along what I do have. My goal in this, as I said last week, is to make a case for the idea that doubt is not something to fear or to shy away from, but rather something to engage in a wholehearted way, and to engage it wholeheartedly as the key to moving along in our spiritual journey, to evolving our faith. My hope is that this will be an encouraging and liberating experience for most of the folks that would find themselves feeling at home at the table, given that we're a community that exists to facilitate the exploration of what we believe. So, this is a model that works with the idea of stages of faith. Now, that in itself is not novel. That's a notion that's been around for a long time, and it's one that I have both some affection for and some reservations about. I like that it makes visible the idea that our faith can evolve and change, and that we can experience those changes as positive. We can experience them as what we might call growth. I don't like that it suggests a progression from lesser to greater faith. We'll get into this more another time. But let me say at this juncture that that's very much not the point. I'll use several different metaphors to illustrate that, but I can almost promise you that it'll still be something that we wrestle with a fair bit. The Western mind, our imaginations, are so conditioned to think of growth as linear, as movement from inferior to superior, from weak to strong, from childish to mature, that it's a hard idea to shake. There are lots of other worldviews that work in circles or that in recirculating experiences and so on that challenge that Western inclination to linearity. But it's going to be a challenge for us. We'll explore that. I'm very tempted to use the language of iterations rather than stages, but there are some ways in which the model that we're using builds on itself that makes stages more an accurate representation, more accurate language. So for now, I'm going to stick with that. In this particular model, there are four stages. You could break a process like this or experiences like this down finer. Folks have used these same ideas to come up with models of lots of stages. I think I've seen ones with as many as 14. But we're going to go with four because, among other things, I can actually remember four. I can carry this around in my head and use it to reference experiences in the world and weigh them, you know? I'm going to refer to the stages this way. Stage one is called simplicity. Stage two is complexity. Stage three is perplexity. And stage four is harmony. And we'll be unpacking all four of those in much more detail as we go along. But before we even reach stage one, we need to talk a bit about something that precedes that whole four-stage model, which we're going to refer to as stage zero. Stage zero is the stage of faith that we're all born into. Everybody starts in stage zero. Some people, for a variety of reasons, most of which would not generally be understood as good, never leave stage zero. We could also call stage zero infancy or egocentricity. When we're physical infants, we experience life as unconscious and all-consuming egocentricity. It's all about me. Our needs, our problems, our desires, they're the whole story. We are our dirty diaper. We are our hungry tummy, our gas bubble, our response to being tickled or hearing a familiar voice. We're incapable of caring about the needs of others because, at least for the first while, we're not even aware of our individual existence, never mind the existence of others. It's very important to note that this is not a character flaw or individual fault. It's just what it means to be a newborn. Now, this might all sound pretty self-evident, but anybody that has ever felt the temptation to yell at or shake a newborn because your adult logic isn't getting through to them might know that we sometimes need to be reminded of this fact. A child, as several ancient sacred texts remind us, thinks like a child. That's not a problem. It's as it should be. What's problematic is when that doesn't change. When we grow older, but don't grow beyond that egocentricity that we naturally start out with. Sometimes as adults, we might face challenges like addictions or other dysfunctions that return us to some of the parameters of infancy, that we might have experiences that cause us to lose our concern for others or to lose our grip on a sense of right or wrong, or to start to operate from a place where our fears, our needs, our cravings, our reactions take over our identity. We become all about those things in a way that the newborn is all about me. And sometimes children are poorly parented, or as is one of the frequent outcomes of abusive environments, like the residential schools we were talking about earlier, they grow up in ways that mean they reach chronological adulthood without growing beyond some of the characteristics of stage zero. For the purposes of the exploration that we're launching into, what's important to realize is that humans in stage zero also have a perspective on things like God and faith. It's one that's perfectly appropriate to their age and stage, but it's not a perspective we would generally affirm as being a good one to continue to hold as they grow. We're going to unpack that more next week. Sometimes, in order to understand our own journey, we need to look back at where we've come from. So we're going to pick this up next week with a more detailed look at what faith might look like for a person centered in stage zero, and talk a bit about why moving out of that into stage one is so critically important. As we get deeper into this, you'll find that that love one another idea that Jesus and many others have articulated is essential to making a better world. And so we might as well, you know, get on with it. And that includes loving those whose language, customs, culture, and beliefs, even about things these days like God and vaccines, are not like mine. To do otherwise is to continue on a trajectory related to the one that gave us institutions like the residential schools. And honestly, I think we can do better than that. We had better be able to do better than that. Listen, this can be hard work. So this week, maybe think of a way that you can safely encourage one other person on that path. You can offer some support to somebody, maybe just somebody that you recognize as different than you in their beliefs or their faith, or maybe somebody that you know that's going through experiences that are stirring up doubt for them, that might be wondering if it's okay to doubt. Maybe they've never heard that doubt can be an awesome catalyst for growing faith. And just that perspective might offer them something to hold on to in a difficult season in their life. And then we'll get together next week and we'll keep exploring. Thanks for listening. Peace. Bye for now.